In the madman theory of diplomacy, if your opponent thinks you're crazy enough to do anything, they'll agree to your terms. It only works if your opponent thinks they could lose.
The Iranian leadership doesn't think that they're losing.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, the danger of brinkmanship in the war with Iran. Also, a journalist from Afghanistan remembers trying to keep his newspaper alive after the Taliban came back to power.
People are trying to leave the country with any cost. I was thinking, let us continue.
Plus, a political satire in Spain has moviegoers riled up.
And a Japanese drummer breaking glass on stage. People love it.
I want to do different way, you know, different thing.
All coming up today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here. We begin this Monday with a word, brinkmanship, the high-stakes strategy of pushing a conflict to the edge of a worst-case scenario so your opponent backs down.
If the rhetoric coming from President Trump in the last 48 hours regarding Iran is, in fact, brinkmanship, it's taken the concept to a dangerous new level. From his Easter morning Truth Social post vowing to wipe out Iranian power plants and bridges if they don't open the Strait of Hormuz by Tuesday night, to today's press briefing where Trump reiterated the threat, saying Iran can be taken out in one night and that might be tomorrow night. We kick things off with Dan Dresner, the academic dean at Tufts Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, to get a sense of where things stand right now. Although leaders at war have long paired threats with diplomacy, Dresner says what Trump is doing now is different.
Trump is threatening to basically instigate war crimes. He's made it clear that he wants to bomb civilian infrastructure, power plants, desalination plants, and so forth. And this is a violation of the laws of war. I suspect Trump thinks of this as a violation of the laws of war as a way to attain a bargaining advantage. It shows how extreme he will be as a way of trying to coerce Iran into some kind of acquiescence.
Some listeners will remember President Nixon's attempt to end the Vietnam War by trying to convince Moscow and Hanoi that the U.S. under Nixon was crazy enough to use nuclear weapons to end the Vietnam War. Bomb Hanoi was kind of the call of the day. Nixon himself called it the madman theory of diplomacy. Is Trump channeling Nixon?
There is no denying that Trump loves the idea of the madman strategy. He has said it before. He actually has instructed during his first term, he instructed multiple negotiators who were dealing with various aspects of North and South Korea to say that Trump is crazy, that he could potentially do anything. And you could argue to some extent that that is sort of a variant of what he is trying to do in his current strategy. The problem, though, is that for there to be a negotiation, for a war to come to an end, one of the two sides has to lose their theory of victory. In other words, one of the two sides has to think, okay, we can't win this war. We are better off negotiating a truce. And in the current moment, the United States doesn't necessarily believe this, although clearly Trump wants to end the war quickly. But equally important, the Iranian leadership doesn't think that they're losing, because their goal in this war is not necessarily to defeat the U.S. on the battlefield. Their goal is to survive. And since the June bombings of last year, the Iranian regime has clearly reconstituted itself to be able to survive this kind of attack. And they think that they have a chokehold on the U.S. by their control over the Strait of Hormuz.
What does history tell us? Does the madman theory, this idea of gaining concessions by appearing irrational, has it worked?
No. Simply put, the example you cited of Richard Nixon, archival research shows that, in fact, the Soviets were entirely aware of what Nixon was trying to do. They did not think of him as a madman. They knew that this was a negotiating gambit. Similarly, Trump's efforts to employ the madman strategy during his first term didn't really lead to a better trade deal with South Korea, and it wound up leading to fruitless negotiations with North Korea. Part of the problem with Trump is that he's fighting his own reputation here. You talk about the madman theory. There is also the acronym TACO, which refers to Trump always chickens out if markets react badly to his bellicose threats. And in some way, in order to fight that reputation, he has to act in a more extreme manner. But that reputation persists, and it's possible that the Iranians think that as the price of oil approaches $150 a barrel, that Trump will eventually acquiesce.
What other examples would you point to of leaders who have tested the limits of brinksmanship? We know Putin has raised a shroud of nuclear weapons in the past.
Yes, but it should be noted that he did that from a position of weakness. Generally speaking, when Vladimir Putin invokes nuclear weapons, he does so because he's perceiving that his side is losing. And, you know, one of the areas where Russia is still a superpower is in terms of its control of nuclear weapons. So usually when he's doing that, it's because he's operating in a domain of loss. And that threat, the nuclear threat, has actually become less credible over time precisely for that reason. You can point to examples in the past. There are some who argue that Hitler actually imposed the madman strategy during the run-up to the Second World War, you know, in terms of the annexation of Czechoslovakia. But the general problem with the madman strategy is twofold. First, even those who have potentially successfully used it tend to get addicted to it and inevitably overreach and then stumble into a war. The second problem with it is that for any kind of coercive bargaining to take place, you have to provide two credible assurances. The first is that you will punish actors that refuse to negotiate an agreement. But the second credible assurance is that if the other side does come to the table and agrees to a deal, you will honor that deal. The problem Trump has is that he has made it clear that he was willing to carry out threats, but I don't think anyone necessarily believes that he will stick to any deal that is actually negotiated.
Yeah, so what does all this tell us about Trump saying, I'm going to blow up everything over there?
I think he is talking himself into a rhetorical corner, because at this point, I doubt that Iran is necessarily going to acquiesce in the next 48 hours or, you know, unless there's some sort of fig leaf suggesting a ceasefire, I really don't think Iran is going to back down, in which case Trump is then faced with one of two choices. Either he has to extend the deadline or back down, which will cement the taco perception of him, or he will commit war crimes.
Does it mean that Trump is in a weak position?
Yes.
Does his volatility seem to be frightening Iran's leaders right now? What are you seeing?
I think you can argue that you know, Trump is always pursuing what game theorists refer to as a randomized strategy, which is the idea that there's a 50-50 chance that he'll escalate or de-escalate. And maybe the hope is that he will, you know, somehow convince the Iranians that acquiescence is the better option. But part of the problem when you're dealing with the Iranians is that it's not entirely clear who is in charge over there. In no small part because anyone who claims they're in charge runs the risk of being bombed by the Israelis and the Americans.
So you were talking earlier about interlocutors. What role do you see the regional mediators like Pakistan, Egypt, or Turkey playing in trying to shift the balance from brinksmanship to negotiation? Are they making any headway?
It's not clear to me that they are, in no small part, not just because it's not clear who is negotiating on the Iranian side. I'm also not sure who's negotiating on the U.S. side. It does seem to be primarily Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner in some cases. I think in the Pakistan case, we also know that they wanted to talk to J.D. Vance. Marco Rubio has been curiously silent on this, despite the fact that he's both the Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. I think one of the issues the Iranians have, if they're trying to negotiate, is they don't know who in the U.S. administration they can talk to that is a reliable negotiator. Because remember, they had the negotiations with Kushner and Witkoff prior to the start of this particular war. I think that's why there was a request for Vance with respect to Pakistan. But, you know, one of the issues that you are dealing with when you're dealing with the Trump administration is that anyone not named Donald Trump doesn't necessarily have decision-making authority.
Finally, Dan, what is your own level of concern with this threat hanging out there from Trump of blowing everything up over there in Iran?
This is a president that has never seen a norm that he doesn't want to transgress. And so we're talking about, you know, violations of the laws of war, violations of international law, and violations of U.S. law. I'm extremely concerned that he is going to do all this, and in doing so, stain the U.S. reputation so much that even long after Trump has departed from the political stage, the United States is going to have to deal with this stigma.
Dan Dresner is the academic dean at Tufts Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy.
Rainy season is approaching the Southeast Asian mainland. That means mosquitoes everywhere, breeding in puddles, rice paddies, garbage cans, any place there's standing water. Scientists in the landlocked mountainous country of Laos have a novel way to prevent mosquitoes from making people sick. But seeing it in action can be a little jarring. Patrick Nguyen has that story.
Imagine a stranger rolls up in front of your house on a bike, pulls out a jar, and releases a cloud of mosquitoes. That's been happening a lot in Vientiane, the capital of Laos.
It's very new idea, new method, and it's the first time in Laos.
Dr. Putmani Tamawong runs a project called Driving Down Dengue in partnership with the Lao government. Dengue is a menace in warm, rainy places. In Laos alone, tens of thousands of people get it each year from mosquitoes. Often dozens will die. Lao people call dengue Kai Luat Ok, the bloodletting fever. It can cause joint pain that feels like your bones are breaking and blood running from your nose and gums.
The Lao health system is not very strong, so we need to control and prevent dengue transmission.
Good hospitals are scarce in Laos, one of the world's few remaining communist countries. Most Lao people are farmers. Many can't afford treatment at all. But Putmani, an insect expert, has a solution to dengue. Strange as it may sound, it involves putting more mosquitoes in the air in people's neighborhoods.
It's very important to make the community understand and accept this method.
This method starts in an Australian lab swarming with mosquitoes. Nelson Grisales is a scientist with the World Mosquito Program, a nonprofit that runs the Australian lab and others around the world. These places are like mosquito factories, he says, filled with big steel cages.
The cages measure meters and they can host thousands and thousands of mosquitoes at the same time.
The factories breed mosquitoes infected with a bacteria called Wolbachia. It stops dengue from replicating in their tiny mosquito guts. The bugs still bite, but it's not dangerous. These biofactories generate tens of millions of mosquitoes per month. The male mosquitoes eat sugar water, but females feed on human blood, acquired from blood banks.
So we use donations. Sometimes we buy blood from blood banks when it's already expired. Sometimes we buy horse blood too.
The biofactory ships mosquito eggs to Laos. Dr. Putmani and her team just drop them in water bottles and wait for them to grow up.
It takes around 10 to 12 days for them to be adult mosquito. Then we release into the environment.
The dengue-blocking bacteria inside these mosquitoes will pass down to their mosquito babies. So release enough of them, and eventually, through lots of mating, they replace all the mosquitoes that give people dengue. But it's quite an operation. For every square kilometer, they have to release a mosquito swarm from those plastic bottles in 400 different spots for months on end. People often have questions.
It seems counterintuitive. You know, you're proposing to address mosquito-borne disease by releasing more mosquitoes into the environment. How does that make sense?
Luke Ebbs is the Laos country director for Save the Children. The nonprofit helps run the mosquito program, in part by asking people for permission to put extra mosquitoes in their neighborhood.
When we first started the project, before we did any releases, community acceptance was below 20%. That community acceptance has risen to 97%.
Getting there required going door to door with pamphlets and putting out a song on social media about the wonders of mosquitoes infected with the bacteria Wolbachia. This approach has worked really well in other parts of the world. In the Indonesian city of Yogyakarta, dengue cases dropped by nearly 80%. In Medellin, Colombia, more than 90%. So far, scientists are seeing no negative side effects. In Laos, half of Wianjian is covered by the program. They're now working to cover the other half of the capital this year, and they hope to eventually cover the whole country. Dr. Putmani, the insect scientist, says the time to expand is now.
Climate change is one of the reasons that makes dengue cases going high.
More heat and harder rains drive mosquito populations up. But if they're the right kind of mosquitoes, they'll be annoying, but not deadly. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
Up next, what it took to keep a newspaper alive in Kabul, Afghanistan in 2021. You are listening to The World.
Hi, I'm Joey Akin, and if you care about African music beyond just the hits, I'd love to invite you into something deeper. Afrobeat Intelligence is the podcast extension of my newsletter. Each week, I examine the trends, the people, and the process behind the sound with guests like Tiwa Savage, Lojay, Ruga, and Sars. Join us as we unpack how Afrobeats became a global cultural force. Subscribe to Afrobeats Intelligence on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you listen.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Let's go back 5 years to the spring and summer of 2021 in Afghanistan. It was chaotic. The Taliban were on the verge of taking control of the government for a second time, and U.S. forces were preparing to withdraw after 20 years in the country. Journalist Zaki Daryabi was in Kabul. His job was to report what was happening. This was not an easy thing to do, since everyone at the newspaper he'd led was concerned that the Taliban would shut down, maybe even detain staff, which meant that Zaki Daryabi was constantly making tough editorial decisions. He shared his story with producer Shayna Sheely for the podcast Snap Judgment.
There was a lot of questions.
Zaki was the editor-in-chief of an influential independent newspaper called Echelat Rose. And one August morning, he stepped out of his apartment and made his way towards his office.
There was a lot of people, unbelievable, unnormal. Women, children, kids, people from the government.
Everyone around Zaki seemed to be carrying bundles of papers.
Their documents, like the request for the passport, some people had a kind of a plastic bag and some had in their hand without any bag.
In 2021, as the U.S. was withdrawing its troops from Afghanistan, Taliban fighters were advancing across the country. Zaki wondered, would they really be able to retake control of the entire country? And if so, would they have the power to change everything? All Zaki really knew at this point was that he was now surrounded by people who had come to Kabul from all over the country to flee.
It was a kind of sign for me that, oh, the collapse of Kabul is very, very near.
As Zaki zigzagged his way toward the office, a building called House Number 30, he could see up to the balcony where he and his co-workers had pulled lots of all-nighters, working.
Sometimes we were staying for 2 a.m, we were looking at the moon from that balcony.
He could see his staff speaking with one another, smoking cigarettes. He needed to gather his thoughts to figure out what he'd say to them in this moment that felt just so uncertain. Before he opened the gate to House Number 30, he stopped, literally to smell the flowers climbing up the wall.
Yellow, purple, red, green, white.
Zaki took a deep breath.
I think a kind of resist started inside of me. While a lot of people are trying to go and to leave the country with any cost, in any situation, I was thinking, like, let's continue as much as we can. Let's persist. I want to make sure, like, I'm clear enough with my colleagues and enough honest with them to talk about what's coming and what's our options and what's our fear. And I was just thinking, okay, I have a responsibility. Then went to the office to take a coffee.
And then, one of the Echelat Rose cameramen asked Zaki if he could record his speech.
Before that, I was okay. I'm okay. And then when you are giving a promise and it's recorded, you don't know what's happening next month. Actually, I felt a lot of pressure on me and I was off. What should I tell?
Zaki couldn't really say no. He walked out onto the balcony where his staff had already gathered.
Their eyes, their faces, their lines, their glasses was putting a lot of pressure on me. But I knew that, okay, we don't have time. I have to do it.
This is the recording of his speech that day.
I told them three things. One, if somebody want to leave the job and not be journalist, it's your right. If you want to go to save your family, it's your right.
Zaki knew the risks of being a journalist under the Taliban.
I will do anything that I can to protect you, to move you from this country. Two, if you want to stay and work with the Lathros, we will go together. Three, my personal priority is to save the Lathros, even if the government is going to collapse. Doesn't matter how long it takes, what's happening, I will stay for this organization. It's my promise and it's my priority. This was somehow very, very clear on my mind.
The one thing Zaki was certain about, he would stay and fight for this newspaper.
I have to stay on that word, and then I have to stay for that promise. Leaving the country is not only thing that we can do. Let's stay and fight for Etlathros, and let's fight for this organization.
And why were you so adamant about saving it?
Oh, I doesn't have any the other option, because it's kind of my first child as a dad, as a father.
Zaki actually had real children, 8-year-old twins and a 2-year-old. But
I was telling some friends that I have 4 kids. First is Etlathros. So when you born something, you have to grow up it. You have to save it. You have to help it. You have to fight for it.
Afghan journalist Zaki Daryabi telling his story to producer Shaina Shealy. To hear what led Zaki to ultimately leave Afghanistan and how he managed to get out, listen to the podcast Snap Judgment, which tells the whole story. Let's turn now to some animal headlines you might have missed.
It is always nice to be the first over the finish line, first person in space. Well, now we bring you the first mine-clearing rat to be commemorated with a statue. This particular rat named Magua sniffed out more than 100 landmines and explosives in Cambodia. The rodent statue was unveiled in Siem Reap on the International Day for Mine Awareness this past Friday.
Hindu-majority India is trying to close off its border with Muslim-majority Bangladesh. That's a major talking point for Narendra Modi's government. About a fifth of the border with Bangladesh is impossible to fence off because of swampy terrain and a river. One approach that is being talked about, filling the area with crocodiles and venomous snakes to scare people off of attempting an even more treacherous crossing.
And finally, last night, rescuers released hundreds of bats saved from war-torn parts of Ukraine. More than 1,000 people showed up in Kyiv for the event, which doubled as a celebration of spring. All 28 bat species in Ukraine are listed as protected because of declining populations.
And those are a couple of animal stories that you might have missed.
You're with the world. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A new satirical film in Spain is breaking box office records there. Torrente Presidente, or Torrente for President, is about a vulgar, racist ex-cop who accidentally ascends to power. On his way up, he lampoons Spanish politicians of all stripes. It is the sixth Torrente film in a winning franchise dating back decades. As The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona, its anti-hero star has always been politically incorrect, but this time he's just outright political.
José Luis Torrente is a little bit like Forrest Gump gone bad, really bad. With his 1970s sunglasses, pencil mustache, and his signature bigotry, Torrente always manages to offend and to entwine himself in history. He's accidentally thwarted drug cartels and terrorists, uncovered conspiracies. His movies have parodied James Bond, Ocean's 11, and others. All the while, he was the character you made fun of, a caricature of an ever-shrinking group of ultra-conservative Spaniards still longing for the days of dictatorship under Francisco Franco.
Hola, Don Lente. ¿Cómo estás?
Todavía está sacando chicle de la boca.
¿Qué va a ser?
Pues lo de siempre, chulín, coño, ¿qué va a ser?
In Torrente Presidente, the latest, he's as crude as ever, denigrating women, insulting minorities. But in the context of today's Spanish politics, some of it no longer seems so extreme. In the opening scene, Torrente's in his local bar, drinking and putting down Chinese immigrants, homosexuals, and socialists, when some far-right political operatives overhear him. They invite him to a rally of their party called Knox.
No serán ustedes maricones de esos, ¿no?
No, no, para nada. Somos de Knox.
What are you guys, gay? Torrente says at first, but when he learns there's free ham and wine at the event, he agrees to go.
Me parece muy interesante su visión de la actualidad.
¡Comete!
From there, it's a rapid ascent towards the prime ministership. The more groups Torrente denigrates, especially immigrants from North Africa, the more popular he becomes. We need to save Spain, he says in his first impromptu speech. They ban the bullfight but let Muslims slaughter lambs in the street, he says. The Arabs invaded us long ago, he goes on, which led to our great reconquest and to Don Quixote. Never mind that the novel Don Quixote was a parody in its day. Such rhetoric was once unthinkable in the real Spain, at least in public. But today, Torrente's diatribe sounds lifted from a certain real political party's playbook, a party whose name rhymes with the fictional Knox. It's called Vox. The ultra-nationalist group has become the third most important party in Spain, winning more and more local elections and seats in Congress.
Creemos que hay que proceder a la repatriación de los que entran ilegalmente en España.
This is Vox's leader, Santiago Abascal, in November, calling on Spain to begin mass deportations of immigrants without working papers. He argues, controversially, that immigrants are stealing social services from Spaniards, things like health care and help with housing.
Personas que acaban de llegar. Pero claro, a los españoles les dicen, no, es que usted tiene arraigo, usted tiene familia, usted tiene madre, tiene abuelos.
In the fictional Spain Torrente inhabits, he goes on to lampoon the left, too, as corrupt and stiflingly politically correct. In an interview on Spanish TV, Torrente's creator, Santiago Segura, who also plays Torrent in the films, says he sought to spare no one his satirical rod.
O sea, no quiero que sea de un lado ni de otro. O sea, no, quiero una película de todos.
This film doesn't take sides, he says. For me, it's liberating to see viewers from both the left and right united by laughter. That's what we wanted.
Lo que deberíamos hacer es intentar hacer cosas juntos.
Of course, most viewers are partial, laughing harder at their rivals' expense than at their own. It all depends on your point of view. And still, for some viewers, the film's subject is not a laughing matter at all. I caught the film this weekend after I talked with fellow moviegoer Antonia Guijarro. She owns a clothing store near Barcelona. She says she saw in the film less parody and more rallying cry for the far right. We're submerged in political slime in this country, she says. We're more and more lost every day. I sometimes can't even tell I'm in Spain walking down the street, she says. Foreigners are everywhere. You work hard your whole life for some money, she says, only to see the government handing out cash with no strings attached. Guijarro says she liked the film and that she's always liked Torrente, the character. And that's the thing about him. He says vile things, but at the end of the day, he's kind of a laid-back, easygoing loser. And that wins people over. A classic anti-hero who consistently lures the public in to view his repulsive antics. This time around, he also gets some support.
Everyone is a puppet.
With cameos from Kevin Spacey.
And someone has to pull the strings.
And from Alec Baldwin doing his Donald Trump. In the film, Trump's come to Madrid to endorse Torrente, as he's done in real life with other far-right leaders in Europe, including Hungary's Viktor Orban.
It's a pleasure for me to be here in your country that hopefully in the near future will be part of mine.
Que dice que ama España.
An embarrassed interpreter tells the audience, Trump said he loves Spain. Not so much in reality. Trump is furious with Spain since it said no to letting the U.S. use its jointly operated air bases here for the war in Iran. So Torrente Presidente offers a wink or two to potential viewers beyond Spain. So far, critics have called the film offensive, excessive, and weak on plot, but they also agree it's provocative, and its satirical style is no longer so far off from the reality of Spain's polarized politics, which could help make the film the most successful Spanish political parody ever to reach the big screen. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
It has been 4 years since Ukrainian forces liberated the city of Bucha from the Russian military. It had been occupied by Russian soldiers for about a month at the start of the full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. In that brief time, Russian troops had committed mass atrocities in the city, horrifying the world. Inside Europe's correspondent Terry Schultz visited a Bucha memorial this week alongside an EU delegation that was visiting to assure Ukrainians that those responsible for the atrocities there will be brought to justice.
Bucha, a city about 30 kilometers from Kyiv, was hardly a household name before occupying Russian soldiers brutalized the population in the first month of Moscow's full-scale invasion in 2022. When they retreated, they left mass graves of murdered civilians and survivors who'd been tortured, raped, and otherwise traumatized. Now, Bucha is a synonym for tragedy. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Kaya Kallas led a delegation of diplomats and officials to Bucha this week for the fourth anniversary of the city's liberation. They gathered at the memorial to more than 450 victims, holding candles they placed at the base of the memorial. The very grounds of this church, St. Andrew's, was itself a mass grave where 116 bodies were exhumed after the liberation of the city 4 years ago today. Many of them were women and even children. The continued efforts of Russia to conquer Ukraine strikes a chord in Kaya Kallas, whose mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother were all deported from their native Estonia to Siberia in the Second World War. They survived and returned to Estonia. But the mistrust of Moscow was passed on to the High Representative years later and impacts the way she views the Kremlin. I spoke to Kallas at the memorial site in Bucha.
You yourself come from a family that was affected by deportation and Moscow's dreams of territorial expansion. As someone with that kind of a family history, how does it feel to be standing here on what became a mass grave within our lifetime?
Well, this is evidence of what happens if there is Russian occupation. Whoever is saying that, you know, just give your territory away, it's not only territory, it's people. And this is what happens to the people on the occupied territories. They are killed, they are tortured, and also, I mean, their culture is suppressed. So this is what we have to keep in mind.
Kallas would like this not just to be kept in mind, she'd like to see it handled in court. The EU and she personally are driving forces behind the effort to set up a new tribunal to try the crime of aggression, which for the first time could prosecute leaders who order actions like the massacres in Bucha. At the moment, only actual perpetrators can be tried for war crimes by, for example, the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Kallas, herself a former lawyer, believes the new tribunal may deter followers from committing war crimes if their higher-ups are brought to justice.
It is important because there are war crimes that are committed on the soil of Ukraine by the soldiers that killed the innocent civilians here, for example. But at the same time, there are also leaders who are sending, actually, soldiers here to kill people. So they also need to be held accountable. And that's why we need the special tribunal for the crime of aggression. It's still moving. It's moving, but it's of course, it could be moving faster.
Later in the day, the EU delegation met Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who recalled the significance of his country's forces pushing Russia out of Bucha.
People saw that Ukraine was fighting a brutal and irrational, absolute aggressor and an anti-European force, Russia, which rejects everything Europe learned and changed in the 20th century, and that Russia started this war not only against us, not only against Ukraine, but against the progress in human rights, morality, and peaceful life that came after World War II.
Zelensky called on EU leaders to help Ukraine now move into its future, despite the ongoing war, to become a member of the bloc as soon as possible.
Ukraine's EU membership is a security guarantee for us and for Europe. Our potential, human, technological, military, is Europe's potential. Russia understands this, sometimes better than some in Europe. That is why Russia does everything to stop Ukraine from joining the EU. And that is why we are doing everything to make it happen. And I thank those in Europe who support us.
Foreign Policy Chief Kallas also thanked Ukraine, which she called the shield for Europe. She assured Ukrainians their future belongs with the European Union. Terry Schultz, Kyiv.
That story was brought to us from DW's Inside Europe podcast.
About 20 years ago, a snare drummer from Japan started getting invited to play solo shows around the world. Over that time, his shows have gotten wilder and wilder, and pretty quickly he became notorious. Up on stage, he smashed bottles, shoved around furniture, even threw his drum. Now he tours the world with a chaotic DIY show, leaving a trail of smashed equipment and adoring fans in his wake. Reporter Jamie Fullerton witnessed the show in Warsaw, Poland in 2024. We reach back into our music vault for this one.
It's Friday night, and I'm in the back room of a rock club. On stage, a man dressed in black is bashing a microphone against a table. His face is hidden by long black hair. He starts shoving a snare drum around the table and hitting the drum with wire drumsticks. It's a sellout show, 130 people. Next to me, a young man with black hair braids and the word heroin tattooed on his shoulder nods his head in time with the beat. The man on stage plays faster. He pushes his face into his drum skin and snorts. This is Ryosuke Kiyosu from Japan, and Warsaw loves him. Over the past 20 years, Kiyosu has made bashing drums, tables, beer glasses and noses an art form.
I think there is something about like watching other person express themselves without constraints.
Kiyosu's show isn't for everyone, but Magda Korzeniuska, who booked him to play the Warsaw Club, told me she understands why he's got a devoted following around the world.
I think that might be pretty cathartic to people because we are like pretty restrained in everyday life. This might be like super appealing to people who feel like they vicariously live through his performance with this freedom of expression.
I put on coin to glass and I shake the glass and broken the glass, then play snare drum. It's kind of a weird snare drum performance.
Kiyosu is telling me about his unconventional first solo snare drum performance in Toronto. He was born in Japan in 1980 and moved to Canada in his early 20s with a snare drum in his suitcase.
I want to do different way, you know, different thing, you know, something different. So I was like, I found someone, the empty bottle, you know, on the table. Maybe I'm gonna use this for the stick, you know?
Kiyosu played drums in a death metal band, but his snare drum solo shows were where he really carved his niche. He'd take a beer bottle from the crowd and hit his drum with it. He'd jump on tables. He tells me that at one early show, he accidentally cut himself with glass. Did it hurt?
Yeah, very hard. But at the time, I didn't hurt, you know, just keep doing. And then I played 30 minutes and I realized, wow. Breathing. I didn't know that, you know.
You had blood all over your arm.
Yeah.
Kiyosu's shows might be wild, but they're not just jackass with drums. He's a brilliant percussionist. When he started playing solo shows around the world, he attracted death metal fans, jazz fans, hipsters, all kinds of people. The Chinese government isn't such a big fan of Kiyosu. He was scheduled to tour China in 2016.
One promoter, Shanghai promoter, called me, "Hey, Kiyosu, your show all canceled from the Chinese government." Then I asked why. That because your performance is violence, also bad for young people. That's why we cancel all your show.
Chinese police said Kiasu's shows were violent and would be a bad influence on the youth.
Do you think they're right or wrong? Is your music violent?
I have no idea. Right, yeah.
Kiasu couldn't play his China tour, but he makes a living from his music. He spends about 6 months each year back in Japan, playing in metal and jazz bands. For the other 6 months, he tours the world with his manic solo snare drum show. He's lost count of the countries he's played, but it's more than 60.
Because I found out about this guy in the TikTok.
Kiasu is in his mid-40s, and his show in Warsaw is full of people half his age. Everyone I speak to here says they found out about him through social media.
I've seen it on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, like everywhere.
A video of Kiasu performing in Taiwan has 4.4 million views on TikTok.
We've seen you on Instagram. Amazing show, amazing show.
Yeah, we love.
But Kiasu says he doesn't have a social media strategy. He says that all he's focused on is his almost never-ending world tour.
I think it's the only way to bring my music to the people. I think the real music is it have to feel, I think, the same atmosphere in the same room. My music is live music. That's why I have to the tour.
Do you call your show a music show or performance?
I think a music show, because I'm always thinking about music. I never think about performance during the show.
Kiasu ends his show by jumping on the table, breaking one of its legs, then whacking the table leg with his drumstick. For The World, I'm Jamie Fullerton in Warsaw.
You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Seema Jalani is a Pakistani-American doctor who has lived all over the world. She's treated people in war zones in Afghanistan, Iraq, Ukraine, and many other places. Her search for a place that feels like home led her to tell this story on GBH's Stories from the Stage.
It's 1992. I'm 12 years old, walking through an airplane. My father shouts, as per usual, "Kids, get to the back. It's cattle class again for us. We must be moving again." From Indonesia to Nigeria, Venezuela to London or Los Angeles, it has been the story of my life. This time, it's to Texas, home of big oil. Of course, for daddy's job, oil and gas engineer, makes sense. Texas is a long way off from Pakistan, which is where my family hails from. I'm in the middle school cafeteria. The girl next to me looks me up and down and says, "Your skin is the color of poop." That hurts. I'm not going to let them see me cry. I run home to mama that night. "Mama, there were mean girls there today." She looks me straight in the eyes, grabs my shoulders, and says, "Honey, this is our home. You gotta make it here. Be a survivor." By high school, I'm slathering bleaching creams and lotions all over my body to whitify myself. By college, it's flat ironing my hair. On the cusp of 21 years old, I watch those magnificent towers fall to the ground on 9/11, and somehow I'm dealing with death threats. A month after that, I'm in a Manhattan skyscraper interviewing for medical school. The interviewer says, "Have you ever read Dante?" "Yes, yeah, in my honors great books class." "Then you know that he put your people in the seventh circle of hell, exactly where you belong." I didn't rehearse for that one. Onwards to Chicago, to Boston. "Does your dad teach you how to make bombs? You gonna wear a burqa when you're a doctor? Is this the home Mama was talking about that I'm trying to survive in?" "Thanks, but no thanks. Get me on a plane to a war zone instead. In medical school and residency, I write proposal and grant after grant, and I start packing for Afghanistan, for Syria, for Lebanon, for Iraq, all the places and all the countries where my government has had a hand in destroying lives. I am there as a doctor. Bombs are shaking the ground I am in. Bullets go through ICUs. My stethoscope hovers over children's bodies who are bleeding out. I can feel death tickle my throat. I have never felt more alive. I am pulsating. I am fierce. Maybe this is my home in a war zone in someone else's nightmare. That doesn't seem right. No. It's 2017. I'm 30 miles off the coast of Libya on a refugee rescue boat. Icy waves are crashing into us. 423 souls on board, and it's my job to keep them alive. I am passing out blankets and formula. I feel home here, adrift in the Mediterranean Sea. But I do, and then I look up and I see a father. Is that my dad? It can't be. But I recall my dad was a boat refugee. His spirit is here on this boat with us. These people are my home. Their culture is my home. They expect nothing of me except to be of service to them. It's 2020. I'm in Beirut living with my husband and my four-year-old daughter. Boom. The port explosion. One of the largest non-nuclear explosions in history. I am running home to save my daughter. Her leg is gashed open from glass. There is glass raining down on the whole of Beirut. I cradle her, grab her in the ambulance, lullaby her. I doctor her. I mama her. I find my home in my daughter's arms, and she finds me. I march through the emergency room. I have the ketamine doses ready. I can gift her some pain relief. I can gift her amnesia. Nurse, would you be able to help me get some oxygen? I'm really scared. She's going down. She looks at me. We don't take orders from nannies here. That's right. Because I'm still brown, and my daughter still looks white, and we are still in Beirut, and racism even survives an almost nuclear explosion. My daughter is my home, but that's not a burden that I'm going to put on her. She goes through her surgeries, and she will eventually leave my nest. It's up to me to find home. The only constant I have had in every war zone, whether it is Ukraine or in Bosnia or in Afghanistan or in Gaza, is this body, this brown body, these eyes that have witnessed war crimes, these hands that have dug up bones from genocide in Bosnia, this heart that has been broken and bruised over and over again, these arms that have cradled my daughter and continue to, these breasts that have breastfed and worn lingerie and broken some hearts myself, these hips that birthed her, these legs that run with my daughter in our backyard because she is okay. I had my ruby slippers with me the entire time. It was this body. It is my home.
Physician Seema Jalani shared her experiences with Stories from the Stage.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston. and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org and check out more of our original reporting on YouTube. We are at The World News GBH. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.